Anybody has any questions or curiosities left about Ibris also? I think. No? Okay, then we leave the bosonic world. Now, I have to confess, I think it's going to be a little bit challenging to describe superstrings, considering that you have not seen most of your supersymmetry before, as far as I can see from the syllabus. So today I will just go to an example, which optimistically will tell you both what's behind the definition of superstring theory, and perhaps give you a first example of a supersymmetric theory. Now, it's not exactly the first supersymmetric theory you find in textbook, but it's interesting. So, starting point will be essentially parallel to the first lecture. I would like to ask: suppose I have a theory, a quantum field theory, with fermions. So I look at my Feynman diagrams. There are Feynman, there are propagators. I would like to rewrite those in the same sort of Schringer time formalism, and then pass integral over some embeddings of a particle in space-time. So the starting point is the Dirac propagator, which in momentum space for a massless particle is roughly something like that. So I give a massless particle example. If you want to find a, to know how to do a massive particle, you can just dimensionally reduce. Take one of the components of the momentum as a mass. Throw away the direction of space-time. So in order to get this sort of propagator from a first quantized formalism, I need to find some way to describe the gamma matrices. Now, as I indicated last time, every time I want to get something more complicated than the scalar, I will have to enrich the quantum mechanics of my single particle in such a way that the Hilbert space of the single particle gets the extra structure that I want. So in this particular case, we need to sort of enrich the quantum mechanics of a particle moving in space-time with some degrees of freedom, which can give me gamma matrices. And with such that the Hilbert space of this particle somehow will become a spinor. So to do that, I'm going to introduce fermionic variables in my quantum mechanics. With standard commutation relations. So it should be clear that as soon as I quantize the fermionic variables, I get gamma matrices. So that size will play the role of gamma matrices. So how do I rewrite this in terms of this degrees of freedom? I mean, so I will refer to the psi and to the gammas interchangeably. Okay? Sometimes I write them as gamma, sometimes as psi, depending if I want to imagine them as just operators out of my Hilbert space, or perhaps as some variables to be quantized. So we know how to write the 1 over p squared. That's easy. So how do we write the p mu, gamma mu? Well, let me introduce a second auxiliary variable, Grassmann odd. So when I do the integral over tau, I get 1 over p squared. When I do the integral over zeta, I just pull down this factor. Now, why is this interesting? let's look at these two quantities. So fp squared, which essentially I want to identify with the Hamiltonian of my quantum mechanical system. And then we have this guy. Let me call it Q. The main property of this guy is that Q squared equal to H. Which in particular, and also Q commutes with H. So my quantum mechanics sort of has two nice conserved quantities, two symmetries. There's a time translation symmetry. There's some other bizarre Grassmann-Ott symmetry, which squares the time translations. Whenever you have something like that, this is called a supersymmetry. So a supersymmetric theory is the theory which has some extra Grassmann-Ott charges, which roughly square to your time translation or in general translation. This means that I can write this quantity as e to the minus tau h minus zeta q. So, roughly speaking, this is something that represents translations in time, and it's a sort of a weird super time. Grassmann-Ott version of time.
Is Q a Grassmann-Ott variable?
Yes.
So why have we written Q squared equals the Hamiltonian?
Well, it's an operator. So the same way as bosonic variables commute, but bosonic operators might not commute. Fermionic variables anti-commute, but fermionic operators might have an interesting anti-commutator. So this is essentially the anti-commutator of Q and Q.
I shouldn't be thinking about it as a Grassmann operator.
It's an operator. It's really an operator.
Some operator that has anti-commutation.
Yes. Now here P was a variable, but as soon as we go to Fourier space. Okay. So as we did in the first lecture, we Fourier transform, we integrate over the momenta, keeping into account the endpoints. So after you do the Fourier transform, everything. You can try, P becomes an operator acting on axis. We can essentially write this. So if you take a standard quantum mechanics whose variables are positions and size, and I define my p's by the usual commutational relations, okay, then I can write my Dirac propagator in this form. So this became an integral over proper time and some weird fermionic generalization of it, of a transition amplitude from some initial point at time zero, super time zero, to some final point at time tau. And super time zeta. And now the plan is to try to write these also as a nice path integral over the, well, the first step is pretty simple. We know the variables. It's something standard. We just do the, write this as a path integral over x and psi with some action. But what's really interesting is to try to do the same thing we have for the standard particle, which is to promote tau to the zero mode of a, remember in the first lecture, so for the standard, for the particle, for the scalar particle, the final expression we started working with was something like E inverse x dot squared plus E square m plus E m squared the u, right, with the parameterization and parameterization invariance. Such that E du goes to E prime, du prime. And then we fix diffeomorphisms by E equal to tau, by requiring E to be constant. This is what we did. So let's see if we can do the same thing, but in this context of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So I want to have essentially freedom to parameterize my time and supertime by some local coordinates and freedom of changing coordinates. So I'm going to introduce some coordinates, u and theta, Grassmann even and Grassmann odd. And then I'll try to define some supersymmetric version of diffeomorphisms. So one way to think about diffeomorphisms is that they act, there are transformations that act in this interesting way on derivatives. In this case, it's useful to introduce a notion of super, let me say this right. Even before we think in terms of this u and theta, if you just look at this expression, and we call that g of tau and zeta. This is following properties. First of all, the tau g equal to minus h g. Now, to understand what happens with the theta, some zeta derivatives, it's useful to expand it. So it's 1 minus zeta q e to the minus h tau, right? So when you deal with the zeta, I get a q by itself. To get something interesting, I need to do d over the zeta minus zeta plus zeta d over the tau. So that gives me minus q, sorry, e to the minus h tau. Remember, zeta squared is zero because zeta is a Grassmannian variable. So minus zeta h e to the minus h tau. Sorry, plus. Which is the same as minus q g. Is that right? Actually, I really need the plus here, because if I do q g, there is q zeta q. I need to pass q across zeta to get zeta q squared. So this actually means that a lot of the signs that I'll write down in the rest of the lectures are suspicious. Because, of course, I did my calculations with the wrong sign. On the hand, I would probably get other signs wrong while writing, so they might cancel out. Okay, so this shows you that sort of the natural way to think about time translations is just the usual set out, but super time translations are implemented by this operator. So if I want to generalize this to some sort of diffeomorphism and super diffeomorphism, well, diffeomorphisms are generated by vector fields. So they'll be generated by some operator like that. We call that delta V. And super diffeomorphisms will be generated by something like this. Let's see if this definition makes sense. So it'd be nice to check that all sort of commutator and anticommutator of these transformations close to transformations of the same sort. For example, suppose I do delta epsilon prime. Actually, let's give it commutator because epsilon is Gassmann. Classification to a consideration of the Gassmann inner or Gassmann odd. Debatable. Let's say it's Gassmann odd. Okay. So, what do I get? I get epsilon. So, the first thing to observe is that if I take this guy and I squared it, I get actually chu the tau. Sorry, the tau. Because well, almost everything cancels out. Here, I get just 1. So I get the U. So the first thing I get is simply something like epsilon prime, true epsilon prime, the U. Second thing I get is when the derivative, the U derivative, actually acts on the generator. So that gives me something like epsilon theta epsilon prime the theta. So let me move theta on the other side. Plus the one we've exchanged. Sorry. So this shows me that actually this definition was not quite good. It was a tentative definition. But see, when I anti-commute to these guys, I get something somewhat more complicated. Now notice that the thing in parentheses is actually half of the derivative of this. So let me amend this definition.
So here, were you computing? I thought you were computing the algebra of the convex.
Yes.
But I guess you were, but then you just said the anti, but did you compute the anti-commutator?
Or the commutator.
This one, the, okay.
Yes. So I treated epsilon as also a node parameter.
Sure. Okay. Okay. But here you're just computing the algebra.
That's right.
Okay.
So after my amendment, this looks like delta of 2 epsilon epsilon prime. Now I should show you that this guy with this guy does something nice, and this guy itself does something nice. Instead, I'll just show you that this is really the symmetry of something, and so it will be a group. So these are these two generators represent the transformations which act in a nice way on something called the superderivative, which is defined almost as this, but with opposite sign. So the superderivative has the property that it actually commutes with this operator, anti-commutes with this operator. And it squares to minus standard derivative. So
is that a commutator or anti-commutator on the right?
Sorry. Actually, you joke about it, but there is a convention in which you write things with one curly and one square, and that means do commutator or anti-commutator, depending if the arguments are both odd or not. So if you do a transformation of the theta, because almost everything goes through, all you get is actually, let me see, do it right. Well, there is no hope I get the sign right anyway. Write it like that, which is also the same as minus the u epsilon the theta the theta. So this is a transformation which multiplies the theta by something. So if you keep acting with sort of transformations, right? If I keep doing several transformations of this sort, I will always end up with multiples of the theta. Because if I do another transformation, it either acts on this and leaves the theta there, or it acts on the theta and it gets something that still has the theta. Which in particular means that the delta V also ends up multiplying the theta by something. And in general, these are the most general transformations with this property. So a way to think about super diffeomorphisms is that they are transformations which, when they commute with this superderivative, they just multiply it by something. So let me write it up somewhere. One dimension of super diffeomorphisms are transformations with a property that they give back the theta. Now, if at some point you learn some super geometry and super manifolds and things like that, then some manifolds with even an odd coordinates, you can define vector fields on these manifolds. So on this manifold, there are vector fields, the u and the theta. And somehow this is the theta is sort of a special direction inside this tangent space of the manifold. And we only consider coordinate transformations if preserve this direction. Okay. So all of this was just to try to figure out what is a reasonable way to transform my excess and psi in the quantum mechanics. So I'm going to combine excess and psi into something that's called a superfield. And I'll just define the action of these vector fields or this superfield just in the standard way. So, for example, delta epsilon of y, just going to act with delta epsilon and get epsilon psi plus epsilon theta du x, which means that delta epsilon x is psi, epsilon psi. Delta epsilon psi is minus epsilon du x. So this is the general structure of supersymmetric transformations. When you study supersymmetric quantum field theories, typically you have some bosons, some fermions, like a scalar field, some fermions. And the variation of the scalar field leads to the fermion. The variation of the fermion is the derivative of the scalar field. So you encounter this in higher dimension too. This is sort of the one-dimensional toy model for that. And then you can wonder, how do I write an action which is invariant under these transformations? Okay. So there is a way to do these things using superspace, meaning you really write your action as an integral over both u and theta of something. But for now, let me just do it by hand. So I want my action to start with some x dot squared. E inverse. Okay. Now I want to start keep adding pieces to this until I find something that is invariant under super diffeomorphisms. So if I do a super diffeomorphism on this, what do I get? Well, first of all, I might make a variation of my auxiliary variable. I don't know what that is going to be yet. So let's leave it unspecified. And then I should probably put a 1/2. Okay. And then I vary x dot. So it gives me each of the inverse x dot, and then the u of epsilon psi. Which means the u epsilon psi plus epsilon du psi of psi dot. Now, let's look at this last term. In order to cancel it, well, I know how to produce a psi dot, an x dot. So I could start by adding E inverse psi dot. actually, let me put a, again, one half. So what is the variation of this? Can vary psi, or can vary psi dot, or I can vary inverse again. I'm going to integrate these by parts. So part of it. Let me just do it. When I integrate these by parts, one of the terms gives me again this x dot, psi dot. I add it to that and I get rid of the 1/2. Then the possibility is to act with the derivative on this. I'm already starting to get the signs wrong, so I surrender. Okay, so we start, this allowed us to cancel this term because we generate all sorts of other terms. But actually, you can get rid of a lot of the other terms by adding yet another object. So I write it like this. I'm going to add a new variable, which is going to be sort of the super partner of E. Then I play around with the transformation law for that one to make this work. So this will give me the U epsilon psi chi psi, but it will cancel out because psi squared is 0. Then I get epsilon psi dot chi psi. I get the variation of chi, whatever it is. And then I get the variation of psi. See if you can make things cancel out nicely. We're left with a bunch of psi dot x dot psi terms. And I'm going to cancel them with the variation of the gravitino. So I'm going to use my delta chi to cancel out this term. Cancel out this term. Don't believe this sign. And I'm going to use the variation of my E guy. To cancel out a bunch of other things. See, here I got back in x dot square and psi dot psi. So this looks like the action. And this is exactly what was multiplying delta the inverse. So these are the sort of supersymmetric transformations I need to make the whole action invariant under superiority homomorphisms. So now we did the first example of something called supergravity. Is the theory of gravity and supersymmetry, one-dimensional. Mm-hmm.
Is there a natural way to just simply write down this action without having to add the counterterms?
Yes, in this case there is. So first of all, we need to somehow combine these guys into some sort of a superfield as well. So I think roughly the superfield would look like this. Okay. So if I do the variation of this superfield, I get roughly epsilon chi. Plus theta inverse theta u epsilon plus minus 1/2 theta epsilon u theta minus 1. So I think this can be written partly as epsilon of the theta plus theta u of the inverse plus a correction which roughly, so this is roughly the same thing that you found in front of the transformation of the theta. So in a sense, so in the same way as, can I say this? When you do diffeomorphisms on E, so E is like the square root of the metric. E square really is like a metric. So it transforms, it carries indices. So this supersymmetric guy carries some indices in one dimension. And this gives you the extra transformation term. Carries an index of the same type as the theta. Mm-hmm.
So I suspect ultimately we're going to stick these y's to be the guys I'm going to put in my action. But now those x's, when they're bosonic, they were nice and they had like Poincaré invariance and all that. What happened to...
They still have Poincaré invariance.
Isn't that theta kind of
ruin
things?
No, I put the Lorentz index on both. So this is a, you can think of this as a map from some funny one-dimensional supermanifold to standard spacetime. I've not done anything strange and supersymmetric to spacetime. Spacetime is still the usual bosonic spacetime, but the world line has been supersymmetrized. So it's easy to write down the current for the for Lorentz transformations. There's something like the usual x mu p mu plus sine mu So anyway, all of this was just to say that, yes, this action can also be written as an integral over the u, the theta, or something like the theta y, the u y, the theta square y, probably, e inverse, I think. I've not checked. I think if you expand this into components and your data integral, you presumably get the action over there. But I'm not sure. So. You should definitely check this. Right, and I'm not sure this is completely true, okay? It's probably true, but I'm not. So there is whole theory of supergravity. So it is often the case in supergravity. So you can either do things in components, or you can do things in superspace. But how to actually do it in superspace is it's often rather subtle. It's more an art than a science, so the supergravity in superspace. So I tried to package things together in this E. I'm not actually sure it's the right way to do it. I didn't check it. I did this calculation by hand exactly because I didn't want to get into supergravity in superspace. So it's doable, but it takes a certain shape of mind. I mean, there is people whose profession is to write supergravity theories. It's really. In aggregate dimension, it can get very complicated to write down an action which is invariant under super diffeomorphisms and check that all the transformations end up closing. Okay, so what did we do? So we ended up with some action, some nice action. Function of x, psi, e, and chi, which has super diffeomorphism invariants. Now, let's check that we can gauge fix it to get something interesting. Now, from this transformation, it's probably not completely obvious, but the transformation of e squared chi is actually a total derivative. The x squared chi might be, in a sense, x squared chi is the guy that appears in if you invert this e. So you do e, this becomes e plus e squared chi theta chi theta. So e squared here chi is really the super partner of e. If you remember, when we gauge fixed e, we kept the zero mode of e. So in a similar way here, when you do a super diffeomorphism, you can eliminate most of e squared chi, except for a zero mode. So you can use this to make e squared chi into a constant. which is nothing but the zeta. The head up there. And after you do that, you can use diffeomorphisms to fix E to also be a constant. Doubt. So after you do this gauge fixing, this action becomes something somewhat simple. Really check me on this too, because I'm not 100% sure. But what you get here, after you rescale tau, so the end appears at the end here, is supposed to give exactly that. So the path integral with this action is supposed to give exactly the Green's function. So roughly, this sort of first order action, psi psi dot, is the sort of thing you need to get anti-commutation relations like that. So when you quantize this action, you end up with the psi's become gamma matrices, x dot becomes p. This gives you Q, and this gives you the Hamiltonian. So anyway, enough about the spinning particle. All of this, besides giving you some examples of supersymmetry, was supposed to be an invitation to superstrings, in the sense that the way, so there are several different ways to define superstrings, several different formalisms. There is one called the Grishworth string, which has a sort of a normal worksheet, which moves in sort of a supersymmetric spacetime. Unfortunately, that's very hard to quantize. Then there is something that is called Neville-Schwarz-Ramon superstring, different way to realize the same theory, where you do something completely parallel to this. So you start with the supersymmetric worksheet, embedded inside standard spacetime. Which means that your super worksheet means it's a worksheet with is equipped not just with a metric, but also with a gravitino. It's equipped with coordinates and super coordinates. And then this embedding is described by some superfields. So you end up essentially with the theory of bosons and fermions coupled to some supersymmetric version of the metric.
What are the indices of chi? Are we saying,
you
know, we can have more?
Some spin orientation. So the gravitino is something that has spin 3/2. It has a vector index and a spinor index. Your coordinates have a vector index or a spinor index. Now, the fact that the theta is a spinor can actually be seen already in 1D. If you look at how we define the diffeomorphisms. Let me just, is this line visible? Perhaps not. Okay. See, this is a standard diffeomorphism together with a rotation or rescaling of theta. Theta is rescaled by half of the amount would rescale a derivative or a vector. So already in 1D, theta was a 1D spinor. So here in 1D, we managed to do things without using 1D gamma matrices. Okay. In 2D, you'll need to start to use 2D spinors. Now, writing down the supergravity theory coupled to these fields is a pain. It can be done, painful. Perhaps not very instructive. But the point is that this sort of setup still has wall invariance. Actually, it has wall invariance together with a supersymmetric generalization of that, which comes from commuting super diffeomorphisms with wall transformation. So this is super diffeomorphisms and super wall. So you can use, when you can gauge fix, you can use this freedom to get rid completely of both the metric and the gravitino. So you can gauge fix in such a way that gravitino is zero, and the metric is the usual diagonal metric. And you end up with something that is a, so you can do it locally, and then you need to glue the patches together. And the patches are glued together by super conformal transformations. Now, I don't want to discuss what 2D super diffeomorphisms are. That's complicated. But 2D super conformal transformations are very easy. They're just the holomorphic version of that. So you have some local variables z and theta and some anti-holomorphic variables. And your code super conformal transformations are basically, you know, vz dz plus 1/2 dz v theta d theta, or the compass conjugate. And epsilon of z. The theta plus theta the z. Okay, so they're really the supersymmetrization of the holomorphic coordinate transformation. All that is left from this gauge fixing, well, this gauge fixing has to be done properly, of course. So you have your ghosts, okay, and your.
The thing you wrote to the right of the z theta coordinates, are those the generators of the superconformal transformation?
That's right. Okay. So they just look identical to the 1D ones we wrote. except that they use holomorphic coordinates or anthropomorphic coordinates.
When you say you got super good morphism and super wild, is that for, what's the form of the action? Is it the same as before, just wild?
It's a supergravity action, which means I don't know it and I don't want to know it.
Okay.
I might have to learn it at some point. But
yeah. When we consider the bosonic string, we can either have closed strings or open strings, right?
Yes.
But here, when you're adding a Grassmann variable, those boundary conditions won't be like modified somehow?
Not that much. So now there is a stress tensor. And there is also a super stress tensor, a super current action, which comes from variations with respect to the gravitino. So we express some a boundary condition in terms of constraints on the stress tensor. In supersymmetric, super conformal setup, you have some constraints on the super current. Again, the constraints are just the normal component equal to zero, pretty much.
Didn't you really use the fact that we're using closed strings to set the delta of epsilon squared or chi to be a constant? Because we said it's a total derivative, so we can.
That was in 1D.
Oh, I see. So in general. All right, the action. Okay.
No, sorry. You. No, you're right. You're right. I shouldn't say chi equal to. Should I say or not say? It's a bit subtle, see? Why did I say that you cannot get rid of the zero mode? Because you could if the dots, if your transformation was linear in U, right? So in general, the question if can you really put chi to zero or not is global. Locally, I can. The same way as I can put a metric in this form only locally. Globally, I cannot. And these super conformal transformations patch together different coordinate systems with this gauge choice, I think. Again, I've not done this in detail myself, but that's what I understand is the story.
Is epsilon here? Is it Grassmann values, or is it
a Grassmann? I took
epsilon.
It's a bit of a convention. If you take a Grassmann value, then these are these transformations are all bosonic.
Okay.
Yes, it's a Grassmann value. Okay, so as I was saying, this gauge fixing is going to give us some ghosts. And some super ghosts, usually denoted as beta gamma. And these ghosts and super ghosts will essentially combine together with all the matter fields to give us some VRST charge, which will. Which, among other things, will implement the equations of motions for the metric and gravitino we got rid of. So, right, so if you remember, in the bosonic string, right, we had some negative norm state because we had an x-naught. And then the BRST quantization, the restriction to physical states, modulo null states, got rid of those negative norm states. Now, because there is a psi-naught as well, that also gives negative norm states. And those are killed by these other physical state conditions that come from G. So your physical states are going to be killed by the Fourier modes of T and the Fourier modes of G, roughly speaking. So now, see, once we get here, everything is good. The action is going to be free, quadratic. These are going to be free fields. They're going to be free fields, free fields, free fields. The square ghosts are still a bit of a pain to describe sometimes because, for various reasons. But it's doable. It's all doable with free fields. The physical state conditions are then straightforward imposed. Or if you want to do things properly, you can use your BST charge. Again, painful, but doable. So there is nothing, no mystery left on the worksheet. Of course, if you want, when you do loop calculations, things can still get complicated conceptually because you need to think about all the possible ways to patch up together a supermanifold out of these sort of flat patches with super conformal transformations. There's a certain theory of super Riemann surface that one has to understand to study loop calculations. But at three level, not really. So in the next lecture, we'll hopefully be able to just sketch the very basic first steps of the analysis of superstring theory. We will not be able to compute the Weyl anomaly of all of this stuff. So I can just tell you now. So this, we knew it was minus 26. This turns out to be plus 11. This was plus 1. And the fermions give plus 1/2. So this theory makes sense as a quantum theory if the dimension is 10. So if mu goes from 0 to 9. And similarly, I won't be able to compute things like the Casimir energy of the ground state. So, but if you allow me to just give those, then we can just do the standard analysis of physical state conditions and at least figure out what is the spectrum of superstrings.